hand that kind of calls for everyone to do their own part. So, like, you going the down
common
there.
Common cause.
Well, the cause is already happening. Like, the fires are occurring. If there's no rainforest, our oxygen levels deplete. The atmosphere changes. When people have a bunch of asthma in the next county over, we're like, well, how'd that happen? Is it natural? It's not natural, but it's a natural effect of what occurs when we don't address these things. But every one of you out there has a special place on this planet and in the labor force. This is the way we have been expressing it. Is it time for a new form? It's definitely time for a new way. Thank you for listening to Labor Radio. And it's 6:30 approaching on September 2nd. Have a great Labor Day and keep on keeping on.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
This is Prison Pipeline from the studios of KBOO Portland. I'm Amy Johnson. Would you risk arrest for life on Earth? That's the question in the air as I speak with valve turner Michael Forrester, who spent 6 months in prison for shutting off a tar sands pipeline in North Dakota, and Bonnie McKinley, who hosts workshops in Portland, Oregon on civil disobedience. This conversation takes place 18 days before the global climate strike on September 20th, 2019, which is expected to be the largest mass demonstrations to demand action on the climate crisis to date, and it kicks off a week of action. Michael Forrester was a mental health counselor for 20 years. He stopped working so he could volunteer full-time on climate issues. Michael is a co-founder of 350 Seattle and helped to start a local Plant for the Planet group. For a period, he had a website, Climate Change for Families, which later became Climate Action Families. On October 11th, 2016, Michael shut off a tar sands pipeline in North Dakota by turning a valve off. This action was in coordination with other activists who shut off 4 additional pipelines, stopping 15% of the U.S.'s oil supply that day. Read more about that action at shutitdown.today online. Bonnie McKinley is a retired public school teacher. She works with friends and allies to stomp out fossil fuel projects that threaten our special planet. She works on a climate every day, schemes, goes to meetings, makes props, banners, and costumes, and gives workshops on action, design, and civil disobedience. And is with the Folly of Rack Troop. Welcome to Prison Pipeline, Michael and Bonnie.
Hey.
Thank you.
Hi. Thanks so much for being with me. Michael, let's start with you. Could you tell us more about the action you took part in on October 11th, 2016, and what took you from organizing groups to deciding to break the law?
Yeah, it was a great idea to stop some of the existing oil flowing into the country from Canada's tar sands. And I was just one person in this group of 5 people who were committed to cut chains, open gates, trespass, cut another chain, turn the safety valve on the pipelines coming into the U.S. near the Canadian border. And we stopped 15% of the nation's oil supply, or an amount equivalent to 15% of our daily consumption. And we had support folks who were videoing and getting photos. And we called the pipeline company in advance to say we're doing this. It was a really wonderful, well-coordinated action. And we took our time planning it. So, I mean, if there's anything I can say to people about getting involved in direct action, other than it feels great to actually be able to do something to actually stop oil or gas or coal, to actually make a difference for life on Earth, when everybody always feels so hopeless about climate disaster and the inevitability of it, it's pretty wonderful to be able to actually put your body in the way of something and make a difference. But the one thing I would say is get involved, go find a group. There's lots and lots of actions being planned. Some of them are more like sustainability fair, Earth Day kind of events, and some of them are going to be a lot more. And some of them, a group of people will risk arrest. And that's what we did. We actually waited to be arrested, knowing that we would then go to trial and try to prove that what we did was necessary to prevent a greater harm. It's called the necessity defense. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and people can look online. There's a website, shutitdown.today, and they can see the stories and articles about the valve turners. That's been a couple years ago. I'm still on probation, so I'm not arrestable right now.
Yeah.
But I am helping groups, you know, figure out what they want to do and organize and turn people out for the week of climate strikes.
Yeah, the ones that are coming up on September 20th to 27th. I think it's going to go to the 28th here in Portland. I just wanted to ask specifically, why did you find it necessary to break the law to make the point that you did by turning off the valves?
I had a kind of a charmed life as an activist. It seemed like everything I touched was just, you know, turning to gold. It was wonderful. It was growing. It was successful. And I was part of organizing kids in a lawsuit against Governor Inslee and the state of Washington with Our Children's Trust. And many of your listeners will know about them from the federal case. And the case that nobody said would ever win won. And we had the, you know, this landmark historic victory, and Governor Inslee actually sent out an email saying, you know, if you're as proud of these kids, these climate champions, as I am, and you love clean air, donate here to my reelection.
Mm-hmm.
And then within a few weeks, his administration appealed that landmark historic verdict. And we had met face-to-face with the governor in a private meeting and with the Department of Ecology. And it was shattering to see them handle these kids who were there desperate to say, look, you know, we've won this case. The judge says you've got a few weeks to come up with a climate plan that puts us on a trajectory of climate recovery. Hmm. This is, you know, what everybody around the world is waiting for, the courts to step in and say, okay, governments, you have to do this. And they just wiggled their way out of it. They refused to say anything real. It was just doublespeak and then betrayal. So that was probably the number one thing that radicalized me and realized the courts aren't going to do it, the executive's not going to do it, you know, legislature's not going to do it, corporations are not. Who's going to do it? Who's going to save us from ourselves? And so when the opportunity to actually stop some oil came along, I jumped at it and got to, you know, become like family with a whole new group of friends who we went around and talked about our story, talked about our action, talked about what we did. I did end up going to prison for 6 months. And as hard as it was and as stupid as prisons are and as much as we need to abolish them, because I was there basically as a prisoner of conscience for doing what I knew was the right thing, I had a very different experience. So as bad as it was, I really made the most of my time in there, and I got incredible support, books and letters and people saying they'd stopped flying and that they had gone vegan and they were doing these things because of me. So it was a powerful time for me to be able to meditate and reflect on what I was doing and what comes next. And, you know, I got to say, I agree with a lot of the activists who are saying, you know, the rules, following the rules has gotten us to this moment of complete collapse. So if we're going to keep life going, we're going to have to stop following the rules.
Yeah. I'm curious a couple of things. If you were shocked by any of the aspects of prison that you saw there, and also like what it was like to face the possibility of 21 years in prison, and why do you think you ended up with a 1-year sentence when the maximum possibility was 21 years?
Well, that comes down to white privilege. I think I was in court in a little county in the northeast corner of North Dakota, where, you know, it was like a 90%+ Trump county, but also an incredibly white place. And I'm an older white male. Mental health counselor, you know, I work with kids planting trees. I have no record. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of like the last person you would expect to see sitting at the defense table. And I was there on principle. So I think I got a break because of that. And I'm really grateful.
Yeah.
And glad that, you know, old white men like me who have polluted the most historically and benefited the most and made the most can do our part and spend time in prison if we need to, but at least take the risk of stopping something and making a difference and not letting business as usual go on. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if that answered your question or not.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. The only other thing I had asked was if you were shocked by any parts of the prison system. I know as a sister of a person who was incarcerated, I was, not expecting everything I learned about it.
Oh boy. The whole industry of it, that almost every person I talked to had been in and out and in and out. And the reasons they were going back in were stupid, just stupid reasons, like, violating some probation or parole guideline, you know, not passing a P-test or not passing a few P-tests. And then you end up going back in front of the judge and, you know, they can sentence, like in my case, you know, my judge would say, okay, well, I've got latitude to use more of your 20-year possible sentence here. If I get so much as a traffic ticket, I have to report that to my probation officer. And so any police contact, you know, gets put down on paper. And if I have enough of that stuff, my officer has the ability to just cuff me. And so for people who are dealing with drug addiction and other like real life stressors, and I'm glad that I don't, I'm glad that I'm not, I think it's really difficult to stay out of the system and to get off paper once you've been in. I feel that pressure, and I never had a problem with the law in my life. You know, and at 55, I'm thinking, boy, I gotta keep clean. You know, but why am I so nervous? I never had a problem.
Yeah.
So I can only imagine. And so, yeah, once they get in, then they're in, and they're in again and again. And I noticed that the old-timers really stopped talking about never coming back.
Hmm.
Only the young guys would say they had a plan and they weren't going to be back, and this was it, and things were different now. Hmm. The old guys, they didn't talk that way. They knew better.
Yeah, it's pretty sad how our society doesn't set people up for success and reentry, and the prison systems don't help rehabilitate people, and you know, we don't have support services. We're eroding our social services as a country. I think programs that do help people who are struggling. It's such a
I was the only mental health counselor in prison, and I was in prison.
Hmm.
That's the only reason I was there. It was pretty tragic.
You are listening to Prison Pipeline from the studios of KBOO Portland. I'm speaking with Valve Turner, Michael Forrester, and activist Bonnie McKinley about risking arrest as a climate activist. That's our little spiel for the middle of the show. I wanted to bring Bonnie back into the conversation, and I mean, maybe both of you could answer part of this question, but what is civil disobedience? And where in climate activism is the line drawn between lawful activities and breaking the law or risking arrest?
Well, most of the work that's been done in the Pacific Northwest recently for civil disobedience that I've been involved with for climate has been in opposing fossil fuel projects. And we've been, as Michael said, very successful knocking off one coal, oil, and gas project after another. Most of that work has been done without civil disobedience. People testifying, grassroots efforts, tribal leadership, legal intervention, letters to the editor testifying, going to agencies and convincing certain agencies to deny necessary permits. It continues. A lot of projects reemerge. It's just continual. But we've had a lot of major success. North America's largest proposed oil terminal in Vancouver, Washington, gone. Number of them. We still have a number that we're still combating. But, we find that the civil disobedience actions I've been involved with are a really good way of gaining public sentiment, bringing public awareness to these issues. You know, there's a moral grounding in opposing projects that promise to devastate our planet and life on it. So that's why these civil disobedience actions occur.
Yeah. Is there, I know we're coming up upon the climate strikes, and I'm curious, I think that most of what's planned for Portland that people can join in, definitely the strike at City Hall at 10:30 a.m. on the 20th, and the march and the festival and a lot of things that 350 has planned, they're all things that do not require anyone to risk arrest in any way. So I don't want to necessarily tie the climate strikes to risking arrest, but I'm curious, what is there to find line?
There were more people. I'm sorry, I'm going to just jump in.
Sure.
There were more people risking arrest this September.
Mm-hmm.
I really think it's time. I think people are freaked out. They're anxious. They're ready to shut things down. And I just don't hear a lot of groups planning for that. What I think we're going to get is a lot of movement building, trying to get more and more numbers out into the street, with a very small number of people actually choosing to cross any police line and risk arrest by actually getting in the way of traffic or getting in the way of business.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly these strikes are going to be about turning out more and more people into the streets. The kids have been striking every Friday for a year, and Greta's here in the country, and the UN's having their talks in New York on climate, and it's definitely time to stop business, to whether it's walk out for the day or walk out for the week, and say, I'm not going to pollute. I'm going to let the planet breathe. Just let her catch her breath for a moment while we figure out what we got to do in this emergency. And take the time away from work, the time away from school, and, you know, any time we do that, there's less pollution, number one. And number two, people start to identify themselves as part of creating change, part of a group of people that are going to make a difference and not live the same way we've been living. So I'm hopeful that there will be huge numbers for the 20th through the 27th. I also hope that there will be a lot of shutting down businesses. Some businesses are shutting down voluntarily. I'm noticing Patagonia, and I shouldn't be calling out brand names here, but I've seen on Twitter that a number of businesses are saying, we're shutting down for the strikes, which is remarkable. But a strike technically is when the workers say, I'm not going to participate in this anymore until we have a plan to solve this problem. So.
Yes, stop and plan. We have to do it now. I totally agree. And beyond the strike on the 20th, which is looking pretty legal, but big, and, you know, risk-taking for some people to walk out of school, to walk out of work, to join others in the street. But we hope to take it farther than that during the following week. And there's fossil fuel projects that we're, you know, concerned with and fighting, the Zenith Oil Project in Northwest Portland, Jordan Cove Pacific Connector Pipeline in Southern Oregon, Kalama Methanol, 38 miles downriver from Portland, you know, Tacoma LNG, you know, we've got them. And they need to be vocally and physically opposed.
That's
Bonnie, you probably know more about what's going on in Portland. I'm guessing that if there are groups planning arrestable actions, it's probably more like blocking traffic, like a traffic ticket or a citation or a trespass or something, and probably not any prison time. Is that right?
Right. And when anybody's in, like, you know, we're talking about Michael's prison, you know, he was imprisonment, you know, he was convicted on a felony. There's a lot of arrestable action.
Two felonies and a misdemeanor.
Don't involve that kind of engagement. You know, that might be a path people would take after a while. You know, you never know exactly what's going to happen with your arrest. It could be a citation, like a traffic ticket. It could be 8 hours of community service. It could be a fine. You know, you don't know, but that's some of the things we talk about in our civil disobedience workshop.
Yeah.
What to look out for, what is a well-organized action, and we do have two civil disobedience workshops coming up. I know Rising Tide is giving one September 14th, I believe. I'm giving one this coming Saturday, September 7th, in Northeast Portland, and another one day after the climate strike, if people get hyper-motivated, on Saturday, September 21st in Southeast Portland. So I can be contacted via email.
Yeah, and why don't you say the email now? Yeah, and I'll mention the email again at the end, but if you wanted to mention your email now, too.
Sure. My email is go2350pdx@gmail.com.
Cool. What should somebody consider when deciding whether or not to break the law? And I guess one thing we didn't mention was like the difference of putting your body on the line. Well, maybe this is actually something you'll probably say. The color of your skin and your gender and all these things make a difference in how police interact with you. And could you just say what people should consider when deciding whether or not to break the law and how people can support those who do decide to break laws?
Yeah, that supporting people that do is a really big part. During any arrest-risking action, there are a lot of support people in advance, day of, after, and sometimes for weeks and months to come. I think a lot of self-examination. I give everybody that attends our workshop a lot of follow-up resources. I think it's really important that people consider what's going on in their own life, what their responsibilities are. If they have leftover police entanglements of any kind, they should be aware of how people, marginalized people, may be treated in jail, and they may choose, you know, I think that risking arrest is a right that everybody should have, not necessarily based on their ability to pay for fines. And so it's really nice to work with an organization that can help contribute to fines and things like that. A lot of things that, the one thing that's really important before anybody jumps in, I think, is to have some training, particularly in Know Your Rights. We do have a portion of our workshop that is Know Your Rights, but there's going to be an excellent Know Your Rights, full two-hour workshop on just Know Your Rights presented by the Civil Liberties Defense Center on September 11th at Portland State. And you could go to the Civil Liberties Defense Center website to find out more about that. Know Your Rights is a component of our workshop, but it's not as covered as in-depth as that one. We have other things that we consider, like the tactics. It's really important, I think, for anybody risking arrest to know all the elements of an action. It's not like you just show up and it's there for you. You need to be part of it and understand what's involved. And what to bring to an arrestable action, what not to bring in particular.
Yeah.
So there's a lot that's covered in these workshops.
Well, I'm so glad that you're offering them and that people can take that coming up on Saturday. And we actually, unfortunately, have to wrap it up there. Thank you guys so much for being with me. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline. I'd like to thank my guests, Michael Foster and Bonnie McKinley. Contact Bonnie at go2350pdx@gmail.com. Go to, that's one word, and T-O, 350pdx@gmail.com to attend or find out more about the civil disobedience workshops that she offers, to find out more about climate strike actions being organized in Portland and the rest of Oregon. Visit climatestrikeoregon.org, one word. There are also strikes being organized in Hillsboro, Beaverton, and Forest Grove on September 20th, if you live closer to those. Also good to turn out big numbers in Portland. So that's Climate Strike Oregon. And to find out about climate strike actions wherever you live, go to globalclimatestrike.net. Globalclimatestrike.net, one word. And if there's no strike near you, you can organize one and post it online on globalclimatestrike.net. or on climatestrikeoregon.org if it's in Oregon. Listen to this and other Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Thank you to our engineer, Selena Flores.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad.
but I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. You know, sometimes, baby, I'm so carefree with a joy that's hard to hide. And then sometimes again it seems that all I have is worry.
You're listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM. Stay tuned for Hard Knock Radio.
Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Project Northwest on Friday, September 6th at 10 p.m. at the Atlantis Lounge inside Mississippi Pizza in Portland. Project Northwest is a local zine that helps promote local hip-hop and R&B artists with an emphasis on showcasing artists that identify as Black and POC, LGBTQIA+, women, and artists who experience disabilities. Again, that's Project Northwest on Friday, September 6th at 10 p.m. at the Atlantis Lounge inside Mississippi Pizza, 3552 North Mississippi in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.